Very well. Okay. Thanks very much. Well, let's start then with Mr. Peters. You have 7.5 minutes. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. The central question in this case is whether Daniel Hernandez presented an imminent threat of harm to Officer McBride or any of the bystanders at the scene. That requires three separate determinations before there are any shots fired, after the first two shots, and after the third and fourth shots. No such determination was made in this case, although Officer McBride claims that there were threats made to bystanders at the scene by Mr. Hernandez. There is no other evidence to support that. So we have to, I think, deal with that somewhat skeptically.
Counsel, let me ask you this, given the brevity of time that we have. Let's just say, arguendo, that you're correct as a matter of summary judgment law that, at least with respect to the last two shots, this should probably have gone to the jury. Nevertheless, we have to deal with Casella, the Supreme Court case, and its impact on Zion, which you all have cited. Zion had particular facts that are, in my judgment, quite different than here. You know, you had a situation where someone actually stabbed an officer, was then shot 9 times by someone, he was down, then the officer and perhaps some others walked over to him, shot him 9 more times, and then another officer, perhaps the same one that shot the second 9 shots, kicked him in the head 3 times. Here you have a situation that at least the district court described as 6 shots in 6 seconds. I don't know whether the timing is accurate, but it's quite different there. Then we have the issue of Casella has admonished us, as the court did before, to not look at things at too high a level of generality. We have to look, we have cases that are close enough in terms of the facts that it puts a reasonable officer on notice that he or she is violating the constitutional rights of, in this case, the victim. What I struggle with, and I suspect my colleagues do as well, is does Zion survive Casella in terms of our analysis in this case? I said the federal thing, not the state claims, but the federal claims. If it doesn't, why?
I think Zion survives because it is a situation with both cases present the question of what the officer may or may not do after a suspect has already been shot and is down on the ground. And the steps that have to be taken to determine whether it's reasonable to continue shooting once the suspect is down.
Well, so but he's not down and not moving. I mean, that's the thing, is he shot the first 2 times, and then he very clearly tries to get up, and then he shot 2 more times. And even then, he does not lie prone on the ground. He sort of swings back and starts to show his back to the officer, and that's when she begins to fire the 5th shot. And then even in between the 5th and 6th, he turns over and he seems to put his weight almost on his left arm. So he's moving a lot. So comparing him to someone prone on the ground, I'm not sure is correct.
Well, Your Honor, I think movement versus threat are two different things. He did indeed move, and he was at the point after the 2nd shot was fired. He did move, but there's no evidence that he moved towards McBride, that he continued to present a threat to her. At best, he got up onto his hands and one knee, and I know that the city presents that as being a sprinter stance, and I don't think that accurately depicts what was there. He did struggle to get to his feet. He never actually got up. He was still in a down stance. He never moved a foot forward during the entire episode. Mr. Hernandez remained from 41 to 44 feet away from McBride. So I don't think that in terms of a threat, it really is any different than Zion.
Well, let's say you're correct that this would normally, if there were no qualified immunity, be a jury question. Justice Sotomayor, as you know, in Casella, chastised the majority for doing the very thing that we're talking about here. She said, normally we should follow the summary judgment standard. You have a very good argument that looking at the facts, the issue of the last two shots would normally have been given to the jury because there is a material difference of fact. But given Justice Sotomayor's very, she made the chasm between the members of the Supreme Court very evident. Given that she's not in the majority, and given the six-second interval here and the facts being as different as they are between Zion and Casella, aren't we bound by Casella to treat Zion basically as high-level advice, but that the facts are different enough that there's there's qualified immunity here?
I don't think so. And I know Your Honor is repeating the fact that the shots were spread out over, I think it's about 6.5 seconds, but there were actually two pauses in there. Per LAPD policy, there were two shots, then a pause, two more shots, and then a pause, and two more shots. So it is not as if they were six shots in quick succession. Rather, as per policy, there was a pause in between to reassess.
Let me ask you this, because we have so little time. Let's put aside for a moment the federal case. If we agree that there are material disputes of fact with respect to the final two shots, should we send the state causes of action back to the district court to determine whether those causes of action can survive the state immunity statutes?
I think you would have to, but I obviously would think it would be more proper to send the entire case back, because I don't think Zion is such at a high level of analysis that is inapplicable to this case. I think the basic framework of both cases is the same. We have a man who has been shot, and at that point, the question is, has the threat ended? And even if you look at Plumhoff, it talks about the use of deadly force must cease when the threat has ended. And I know Plumhoff is factually different. It is at a higher level, but Zion is actually particular in the fact that you've got a person shot several times, he's on the ground, and please continue to shoot.
Okay, now your time is up. Let me ask my colleagues whether either has additional questions for this gentleman.
I have one quick question. Is Zion the most factually analogous case that you're relying on?
I would say so, yes, at least the most factually analogous Court of Appeal case. There may be more factually analysis district court cases, but I suspect they would have less weight in this court's analysis. But I don't think Zion is distinguishable, and I don't think the district court attempted to distinguish Zion on the basis of saying it was too general and therefore inapplicable. Rather, it attempted to factually distinguish Zion. So I think at a minimum, the district court erred in its analysis of Zion, whether it applied in this case or not. As I said, the district court did not say Zion doesn't apply. The district court says Zion is factually distinguishable. And actually, quoting from the district court, quote, Zion is clearly distinguishable, and then goes into the facts of why he thinks Zion is distinguishable. It does not say Zion is at too high a level of interest to be applicable to this case.
I could just ask one question. Even under Casella, it's always open to argue that a particular case is an obvious case in which every reasonable officer would have understood that what he or she was doing was unlawful. Do you contend that with respect to the fifth and sixth shots that this is such a case?
I think, yes, that a jury would have determined it was unreasonable. I also think the same analysis would result after the first and second shots. And indeed, under existing case law in the Ninth Circuit and nationwide, I can only think of one case in which the court found that using deadly force on a person with a bladed weapon at more than 21 feet was reasonable. There are numerous district court cases in this district and across the country, that 21 feet, as seen as a cutoff, and that is actually the distance which is stated in police manuals as to the distance at which there's essentially a dividing line between there's an imminent threat and there isn't. And the only case which goes longer than that, which is not at the moment a blank out, I know there was a distance of 55 feet, but in that case, it obviously was the fact that the decedent was running because he covered something like 55 feet in 3 seconds. And there is no way that Mr. Hernandez, after being shot, could have covered 5 feet in 3 seconds. And I've had enough injuries, I've had enough surgeries to know that he had a serious injury. The first 2 shots, he was shot twice in the lower abdomen, which is essentially disabling. He may have mustered up the ability to try and stand up. There is nothing to indicate that he could have ever proceeded past that. So I think, given that he's 40 feet from Officer McBride, he's been shot twice in the abdomen, he never actually moves towards her, I think a jury would have found it was unreasonable to continue shooting at him.
Okay, other questions by my colleagues? All right, I just had one question. I know that it's permissible for counsel to appear by Zoom, but just personally, since you're from Thousand Oaks, what made you decide to appear by Zoom rather than personally? This is the Ninth Circuit. We're not a schlock operation.
Actually, Your Honor, it was the fact that I had to appear down in the Ninth Circuit last week to get a COVID test and then come back again today, which would have essentially taken about 6 hours of my time. And based upon that, I concluded that the extra value of appearing in person, which I don't know was that enormous, at least I've never thought it was that enormous, was worth that expenditure of time. So it was really, it was having to come to the court to have COVID test.
Okay.
Just to come in court and argue.
Very well. Thank you. Appreciate that. All right.
Thank you.
Let's hear for counsel from MLH. That way I won't mess up your name. I apologize.
Yes, good morning. Noreen Mukherjian. Thank you, Your Honor, for your time. I would like to point out Kissela versus
Hughes.
Pardon
the mic there.
Yes, Kissela versus Hughes is distinguishable on facts. It did not change the clearly established law in this circuit that shooting at an incapacitated suspect is in violation of the Fourth Amendment. Why the facts are distinguishable from our case? In Kissela, we have a roommate situation. Officers arrive, see Hughes approaching Chadwick, her roommate, with a large knife and stands towards her, holding the knife within 6 feet. Officers could have perceived reasonably that she could have assaulted her given the 911 call. And the officer resorted to deadly force but stopped after Hughes went down to the ground. There were 4 shots in total fired. And when Amy Hughes went down to the ground and she no longer posed any imminent threat to Chadwick, her roommate, officers stopped. Therefore, there was no, after that point in time, there was no argument for excessiveness of the force. So the court in
basically, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that because Zion was on the books, you believe that the facts are sufficiently close that any reasonable officer would have known that what Officer McBride did here was a violation of the constitutional rights of the decedent. Is that
yes,
right?
Your Honor. And clearly, let me also point out another fact. In Kissela, there was no violation of policy found. Here we have the Board of Police Commissioners independently finding that shots 5 and 6 were in violation of policy, which puts an officer on notice that she's violating a law. And
what policy are you citing, please?
That is the training that officer has a duty to reassess the threat within the shots. The board found that she failed to reassess the threat, she failed to stop between the shots, and this is the key factor that distinguishes Kissela from us, and it does not overrule in any way Zion versus County of Orange, because it still is the clearly established law in this circuit, not overturned.
I think you may be misunderstanding the argument. No one disputes that Zion is clearly still valid law with respect to the issue of whether or not there was a substantive constitutional violation. The question is whether, for purposes of qualified immunity, Zion violated Casella's rule that the rule is defined at too broad a level of generality. It covers too many cases with a sweeping set of language rather than the kind of more case-specific approach that Casella and the subsequent cases have stated.
Your Honor, the way, if we're going to interpret Casella in terms of solely in terms of, you know, what is the standard of qualified immunity generally, that's a different issue. We're looking at the facts here. You are basically trying to tell us that, look, did Casella, as far as I understood from the court's questions, did Casella basically overrule Zion's approach towards qualified immunity? It did not, because Casella simply says, it says right here, the holding, that in this case, even assuming Fourth Amendment violation occurred, proposition that is not at all evident, Casella was entitled to qualified immunity. Why? Because there is no clearly established law that this officer could not have resorted to deadly force under these circumstances. But in Zion, we have a completely different scenario. We still have to look at the morass of the facts, as Justice Ginsburg has said, or Sotomayor has also said, that despite the fact that we have this qualified immunity concept, each and every time courts have to look at the morass of facts, and facts matter. We have facts here that are clearly different from Casella. Hughes was in a completely different... she was not a threat after she went down to the ground, and that officer stopped shooting. We have an officer who fires, continues firing when this man is already wounded. She sees that this man is wounded, struck by bullets, and she continues firing. And clearly the board found her in violation of her training. That is very important. The district court entirely ignored the board's findings.
Where is this board finding in the record?
Well, we attached it, Your Honor. It's in the ER. It was one of my exhibits to my opposition. And if you look at the plaintiff's MLH...
That's ER what?
ER, I'll tell you right now. Let me just look at this index... I have a lot of paperwork here. I apologize, but it is one of my exhibits.
And by the way, which board is this you're talking about?
The Board of Los Angeles Board of Police Commissioners.
Okay, Board of Police Commissioners.
Yes, and it was my index was its exhibit. Board of Police Commissioners, Exhibit 10, which is ER 109, Volume 2.
ER what?
109.
109.
Yes, please look at that.
Are you saying then that because she violated, by your standard, the police commissioner's rule, you're saying that basically cuts out any Monell liability, right? Because she violated the policy. It wasn't that the policy itself encouraged her to do it. Is that correct?
Well, not necessarily. We are just saying, Your Honor, a couple of things. One thing, that she was placed on notice that what she was doing was wrong at the time she shot and killed Daniel Hernandez. That the fact of the matter, she was trained that you need to reassess the threat. You need to stop between the shots. And she admitted in her own administrative interview that I looked and I stopped between the shots. I saw, you know, that he was still popping up. She was saying he popped up and continued charging at me, not supported by video evidence. She knew. She was on notice.
Well, let me ask you this. The Supreme Court, in its qualified immunity cases, talked about the nature of these kinds of cases. Adrenaline is pumping. It's a life and death thing. You've got a short period of time. Is the standard one where we microscopically examine what Officer McBride did second by second? Is that what we do?
No, Your Honor, we don't do that. But we have clearly established law which says terminating a threat does not necessarily mean terminating the suspect. Judge Kaczynski said that in Zion versus County of Orange. And most importantly here, we're looking at motion for summary judgment standard here. This court ignored the dispute of material facts. We're not looking at the jury trial. We're looking at motion for summary judgment. We were not allowed to let this go to the jury. If the jury had determined based on video evidence, based on expert declarations, bystander accounts, that the fifth and sixth shots, even three and four shots, were unreasonable, excessive, then McBride would not have been entitled to qualified immunity.
Let me ask my, your time is up. Let me ask my colleague whether either has questions for counsel.
I had a question about the, excuse me, the discovery issue. It seemed to me that the district court focused primarily on the delay from the summer up until February when the first formal discovery was served. And while even conceding that there may have been delay on the defendant's side, it there was no explanation for the six, or no adequate explanation for the six-month delay in serving formal discovery that could then trigger the discovery process.
Okay, Your
Honor.
Why
was that an abuse of discretion in your view?
Well, Your Honor, let me explain to you. First of all, it is true. You need to remember that plaintiff MLH, I was representing minor plaintiff MLH, came into the case late. We were consolidated into the case in September. Prior to that, the parents had served their discovery requests on the city as of July 2021. The city had promised, as soon as force investigation records are finished, we will produce them to you. I was aware of that. I had to cooperate with co-plaintiffs.
But you know that you can't trigger, you can't begin the motion to compel process and get the courts involved in resolving anything if you've not served formal discovery. And so you were, it's nice that they said that, but you need to start the process, and that seemed to be the district court's concern, that you just took too long to start that process.
Your Honor, but if I had served my own separate requests without, in a consolidated case, without cooperating with parents, I would have been basically attacked as, you know, this is redundant. Why are you producing the same identical request? And moreover, you need to remember, please, Your Honor, this was COVID-19. Offices were closed. I was operating remotely. The city was not even producing to us initial disclosures. I did not get the initial disclosures until March 2021. My office was closed. I did not have support staff. Until we had COVID vaccinations in March, we did not have full staff operations. So as soon as I realized, and I was emailing the parents, I was cooperating with the co-plaintiffs. I emailed them multiple times. I emailed the city multiple times, asking them, what is the status on discovery? Why are you not enforcing the discovery? They were closed. Nobody was responding. So what I did, as soon as I realized that nobody is responding, then I served February my requests. But as a consolidated plaintiff, I had to cooperate with everyone. I could not just start whatever, you know, on my own. And by the way, the city had promised. They said, we are going to send you the force investigation records as soon as it's finished. And I was assuming that because of COVID, they were delayed. So everyone, if you had seen what was going on with the district court, I had multiple cases frozen. We had discovery cutoffs extended. We had trials continuously delayed. No one was operating, Your Honor. And when I was asking for discovery cutoff extension, I asked only for 90 days. The court denied it without even looking at how diligently I was working. As soon as I realized that nothing is moving, there was no, here's the thing. The burden should not be placed solely on plaintiff for delays. Why is the city not acting diligently in responding to parents' discovery? That is the key, because the civil rights victims, we are at the mercy of the police to produce us records. This was a shooting that took place in April 2020 at the height of the pandemic. The parents' case was filed in June 2020. Our case was filed a month after that, was consolidated in September 2020. There was no time for us to, you know, do more than what we were doing. Why did the court not look at the diligence by the city? They failed to act diligently. And furthermore, Your Honor, this is not just the discovery. We were not even allowed to ask a single question at the deposition of the shooter. We were not. My client was prejudiced by her inability to ask a single question at the deposition. They interrupted, they obstructed the deposition after 5 hours, and they walked out on us unilaterally. And when I asked the court, Your Honor, look what's going on, they said, tough luck, your discovery is finished. So basically, we were punished for COVID-19 delays. We were punished for lack of support staff. But the city walked out without any accountability for their lack of diligence in responding to discovery requests and for obstructing McBride's deposition. This is the shooter. Credibility of the shooter is the key. We were not able to adequately depose her. We were not able to get her personnel files. We were not able to get internal review of the incident. The court did not even give me time to oppose the MSJ. I was filing motions after motion, Your Honor. Look, they gave us contact information of witnesses 3 weeks before the discovery cutoff. Percipient witnesses, bystanders, 3 weeks before the discovery cutoff, Your Honor. Is anyone going to be able, under these circumstances, to review thousands of pages of discovery, contact uncooperative witnesses, locate them, get their depositions done in 3 weeks? No. The court did not give us any benefit of the doubt when the city failed to act diligently. And more importantly, the summary judgment should not have been granted under these circumstances because fact discovery was not finished.
Other questions? Judge Lee, do you have any questions of counsel? All right. Thanks very much for your argument. We appreciate it on behalf of both the plaintiffs. Let's hear now from Mr. Gilbert for the City of Los Angeles.
Your Honor.
Your Honor, this is Gerald Pierce. Can I just, you were asking for a citation to the record. I can provide it for Ms. Merkitchian.
Okay.
If the court wants it. 6 ER 931 and 932. And those are both records indicating that the Officer McBride's fifth and sixth shots were found to be out of policy. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Gilbert, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. We're talking about a situation that was 20 seconds in total. And the time that we've been discussing it is exponentially more than what Officer McBride had to determine how to respond to what she perceived as an imminent threat and a threat on her life.
I mean, as the counsel, again, we got the same problem we had before. We don't have a lot of time. Let me just ask you this. Counsel for both the plaintiffs have pointed out that Officer McBride violated, as they represented, known department policy. So putting aside Zion for a minute, does the fact that she allegedly violated department policy make a difference in our analysis and whether Casella controls?
Absolutely.
It does absolutely or does not?
Absolutely not. And in fact, that was addressed by the Maddox Court, Your Honor. The City of Los Angeles, first of all, we're looking at two different legal standards. Under the Maddox analysis and many of the cases that have looked since, the policy is intended to help police departments conduct internal reviews to make sure that its officers are upholding the law and complying with policies. Oftentimes, and especially in Los Angeles, the city's policies exceed the standards established under the Fourth Amendment. So a determination that a policy violation exists is not necessarily tantamount to a violation of the Constitution.
And what would you cite to buttress that position? In other words, you're saying that the fact that the Board of Police Commissioners may have a standard that's in excess of the Fourth Amendment is what controls here. What would you cite, what case, if anything, would you cite to support that position?
So, Your Honor, that's actually discussed at page 24 of our brief. We have a discussion of Maddox versus City of Los Angeles, 792 F. 2nd, 1408. Furthermore, it's a subsequent remedial measures. The determination by the Board of Police Commissioners is looking at information and evidence which is hearsay and is not otherwise admissible. It is for the purposes of making determinations after the fact as a subsequent remedial measure. The fact that the city may look at it may be relevant to a Monell analysis, but that is not a claim that's been advanced on appeal. Rather, it's been dismissed. Furthermore, the issues that are looked at are separate and distinct. It looks at the city's policies, not Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, and a determination is made by lay individuals who are not trained in law enforcement, but are instead a political commission, Your Honor. So it does not have the same force and effect as if an internal body, a chief of police or a judicial officer, was to make a determination.
What, and I don't have the report in front of me, but let's just say hypothetically that the board had said, look, we got this Zion case out there, and you've got to have this in mind. You cannot shoot when someone's already down and clearly not going to come after you. Would that make a difference in our analysis?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Zion, we need to look at the facts of Zion. Zion had three uses of force, three distinct separate phases. First was nine shots were fired while the suspect was upright. Once the suspect was on the ground, the officer advanced to the suspect while on the ground and fired nine more shots. While the suspect was clearly on the ground, and the witness's testimony and the evidence suggested there was a factual dispute as to whether he was in fact moving. Then, after 18 shots had been fired, including nine while the suspect was on the ground, the officer took a running start, ran up, and kicked the suspect in the face. At that point, the suspect was on the ground, not moving, and there was factual disputes on the record. By comparison, we have a video here. We have a video that shows the suspect continuing to move. We are splitting hairs and second-guessing. We have the benefit as attorneys and judges of slowing down the video and looking at it in time and again to see, well, is he moving or not? This is exactly what the Graham Court, the Supreme Court, cautioned against and said, we do not look at 20/20 vision of hindsight. You have to look at it in the context of what an officer who is struggling to decide life and death decisions in real time while an armed suspect is walking towards her. An armed suspect that she has been confronted with has been told is threatening himself, threatening others, who has an edged weapon. Now, there's arguments that it's a box cutter, but I would remind the panel that a box cutter is what caused the 9/11 terrorist attacks and brought down the Empire State Building. This is someone who, on the record, on the video, which is undisputed evidence, is told multiple times, drop the weapon, drop the knife, drop it. And after multiple instructions, he continues to advance. After the first two shots, he continues to get up. He is clearly not lying idle on the ground. We're talking about between the, I'm sorry. Okay. Did you have a question?
No.
We're talking about a 6-second interval at most between shot one and shot six. And even watching the video in real time, you can see that the suspect continues to move on the ground. This is clearly not the same situation of Zion, where you
Counsel, let me ask you a question. Suppose we rule that there's a factual dispute with respect to whether there's been a Fourth Amendment violation for shots five and six, that the jury would have to decide that. But then we rule that qualified immunity applies because there's no factually analogous case here that would make such violation clearly established. So qualified immunity applies. Then say 6 months later, an incident occurs that's almost identical to this. I mean, would qualified immunity still apply in that future case that's almost factually identical to this case?
The problem is that we have to go back to the Supreme Court's jurisprudence and instruction of the Ninth Circuit in particular on defining it clearly established versus too high of a level. If the discussion from the court in a published decision came out and said, in this instance, if there's this many seconds, you can have a gap, then perhaps this could provide the clarity for future cases that therefore it would not be appropriate on summary judgment. But it has to be defined such that, and as the Mullinex court stated, every reasonable officer clearly understands that they are violating the Constitution. And the law must be so clearly established that it is beyond debate. If we can sit and have a debate about, well, splitting hairs between a half a second, it cannot be argued that that's clearly established to the point that every reasonable officer in the country confronted with this situation would know that what they were doing clearly violated the Constitution. We're asking officers to judge life and death decisions in real time without video playback, without pausing. And that is exactly what she's did, and that is exactly what the court, the trial court, looked at and found that when looking at it in real time, it does show that she was acting objectively reasonable. Now, we've talked about
let me stop you there because there's two different inquiries in the qualified immunity context, and one is whether there was a violation, and then second, whether the law was clearly established. And it may be that Casella affects Zion's role at the second inquiry, but it doesn't affect it at all at the first. And so if we were to conclude that there was a jury issue as to the reasonableness of the force as a matter of a Fourth Amendment violation, do you agree that we would then need to vacate the dismissal of the state claims where that dismissal was based solely on there being no violation?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because remember that the jurisprudence between state and federal law looks at whether there's a Fourth Amendment violation or not. And under the state laws, if Officer McBride is authorized to use lethal force, then at least the first through four shots are appropriate, then there arguably would be an establishment that she is faced with an imminent threat. And under California Penal Code, she is able to defend herself. There's been no showing, and there's no evidence in the record whatsoever as to which is the fatal shot. So we have a situation where the court would be implying evidence and reading something in the record that is not there. Furthermore,
but am I wrong in reading the district court's order that the only reason why the state claims were dismissed was the finding that there was no underlying unreasonable use of force?
I believe that's a correct interpretation of this.
We would find that there was a triable issue as to whether there was a reasonable use of force, but that qualified immunity nonetheless applied. We would still have to vacate the dismissal of the state claims because the first part of that would have been undermined, right?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the facts would not support that conclusion as far as the initial...
That's fighting the hypo. The hypo is we've concluded that there's a triable issue at prong one of qualified immunity, that there's a triable issue as to the underlying reasonableness of the use of force. If we make that determination, don't we have to then vacate the dismissal of the state claims?
Not necessarily. It depends on how the decision is made. If shots one through four were adjudicated to be reasonable, objectively reasonable, and not violate the Fourth Amendment, then I think that that supports and continues to support the trial court's holding and the dismissal of the state court claims, because that then authorizes the use. If the fifth and sixth shots are looked at, that's a different issue. And I don't think that necessarily, under federal law, that might be something you'd look at from an objective reasonableness standard, which I don't necessarily agree with, but I don't think that then changes the analysis on shots one through four being appropriate. But I think that this, we need to remember the Polnoff, the Supreme Court's decision there, that addressed the number of shots. The Supreme Court has confirmed that the number of shots is not an issue. It has made clear that an officer may continue firing until a threat has ended.
Well, except that McBride herself indicated that she was stopping to sort of assess, even though it's very brief, to see the reaction to the initial usage. So she herself did not describe this as one firing of six shots. Am I correct?
So, Your Honor, I believe you're referencing the administrative interview, and I believe that is first of all, an inadmissible document. It's a hearsay statement taken out of court. It was not deposition testimony on it. Second of all, the video shows a continuous
shooting. Her own statement
is
hearsay when she's the defendant?
Your Honor, it's an out-of-court statement. It's compelled under Liebarger. It absolutely qualifies as hearsay. If the same testimony had been elicited on deposition, that would be a different standard. But simply making an out-of-court statement that happens to be asked in a compelled statement doesn't excuse the hearsay rules, Your Honor. It still has to be a sworn declaration.
Let me follow up on my colleague's inquiry. So let's assume, just arguendo, that we felt that there was a triable issue of fact, but we concluded that as to the federal claims, qualified immunity applies. If we set it back, the state causes of action, to the district court, in your judgment, are there state immunity statutes that apply in this, where there is a claim of excessive force that would, in effect, provide similar kinds of protection to Officer McBride as to the state causes of action?
So the answer is maybe, and forgive me for the vague discussion, but there is a state court analogy that allows officers to be immunized for the enforcement of investigation, arrest, and law enforcement proceedings. However, that statute and the immunities have limitations when it comes to the situation of force. So, but because we're talking about a chain of events and a sequence of force where there's potentially shots one through four may be objectively reasonable, and hypothetically, let's assume five and six are not, I don't know specifically whether established precedent or California law would necessarily cover it or not.
So basically, there may be a viable claim or claims under the state causes of action if we send it back. Is that correct?
I don't know your.
I'm not saying you agree with it. I'm just saying, since it's not clear that there are immunity statutes that would cover a claim of excessive force, if a jury so found with respect to, say, shots 5 and 6, Officer McBride may still be liable under the state causes of action. Is that fair to say?
Your Honor, I don't feel comfortable agreeing with that, because we have not had the opportunity to look at exhaustively at the state law on that, because those were not issues or arguments that were addressed at the trial court level. This was looked at as one sequence of events in a total of 5.5 to 6 seconds.
Understood.
Unless there's any questions further, Your Honor, I do believe the factual record is very clear and there are no factual disputes, especially given the video of it.
Other questions by my colleagues? All right. Thanks to all counsel for your argument in this case. These cases are always troubling. Sadly, we have a fair number of them. And the Supreme Court has given us some guidance that is interesting. But the case just argued is submitted, and the court stands adjourned for the day.
Thank you all. Have a good day.
This court for this session stands adjourned.